Hi, everyone. This is Paul Gillen. Thanks for downloading this interview with Alan Mutter, the blogger who writes the popular Reflections of a Newsasaur blog. I interviewed Alan on Tuesday, February 17th, 2009. The interview is a little more than an hour long. Alan has a lot to say, and I think I pretty much let him run because he's got so such interesting perspective on the industry. So sit back and enjoy an interview with Alan Mutter about the state of the newspaper industry. What's your day job?
Oh, am I supposed to have a day job?
Some of us do. Some of us are lucky enough not to need one.
Well, I need one. I just can't. I don't actually. I don't work that way anymore. I'm teaching at Berkeley part time. I'm organizing a conference next fall for Berkeley. I'm doing some consulting. I had been doing some independent investing, but for a number of reasons, not the least of which the destruction of my personal net worth, I backed off of that. So I do a number of different things, and I do spend an unreasonable amount of time working on my blog.
Yeah, you've been posting, it seems, even more aggressively lately. Is that is this becoming more of a passion for you?
It's always been a passion for me, and nothing but. I think the reality is that issues are coming to a head, and there's an urgency about the subject of what's going to happen to the media that has grown with the realization of the enormous problems that the media are having. So I think there's a lot more interest in this, and to tell you the truth, the traffic to my blog now is up like fourfold and better than what it was a year ago at this time, month to month. And there's been a huge spike of interest since sort of the beginning of this year. And I'm sorry about that because I've been talking about the same things for over four years. And I'm sorry people didn't listen earlier when they had more options and they had more resources to do things differently.
It's usually the way these things work, of course.
Yeah.
I'd like to know a little bit more about you. I think a lot of people, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you was to get a little bit more background on Alan Mutter, because I think a lot of people are reading you. You're cited in a great many places now, and you don't give much background about yourself in your bio. So maybe you can tell us, like, starting with your early newspaper career, how did you come to be doing what you're doing now?
Well, that was a long time ago, so I'll just sort of hit the high points. I started in the newspaper business in 1970. At the Chicago Daily News, and I worked there very happily, rising through a number of positions. I started out on, you know, the overnight copy desk, and actually was there during the transition from hot type to cold type, and watched what happened to the to these very skilled, well organized, union organized printers, and how they were sent literally into white rooms when their jobs were no longer necessary because there was nobody needed to keyboard things or haul around big trays of type, which were called galleys. I love that work, but in 1978, the newspaper went out of business because we lacked readers and revenues and evidently irrelevance. That was a very, very traumatic for me and all of my colleagues there. I was sitting in a row in a pod of desks where there were three of us. On my left was Tom, on my right was Kathy. At the end of the day, I was left and they were gone. Tom went on to be a high-level editor at the LA Times, and Kathy went on to run such things as ABC News. So it's not as though they suffered mightily at that point, but still the issue of the viability of newspapers was sort of burned into my soul, as it were, 30 years ago. And it's that concern and the realization of what it means when a newspaper shuts down. That's something that's always been inside of me, and that is probably one of my passions apart from my, you know, my family and things like that. So to cut through it, you know, that's how my journey to where I am today really began there. Now, of course, there were a number of side trips. when the Chicago Daily News folded, I went to the Chicago Sun-Times, which was a sister paper owned by the same company. And I was writing a financial column there and continued to do that for a period of time. And then I was offered the position of city editor. So I became city editor of the Sun-Times up against the Tribune, where we were basically outnumbered by 2 or 3 or 4 to 1 on any given story, and we still beat the bejabers out of them. And everything was beautiful there until Rupert Murdoch came along in 1984 and bought the paper, and about a fifth of us left because we didn't want to work there. They had a very strange, peculiar idea about what they wanted to do with the newspaper, and it was anathema to us, so we left. And that led me out to San Francisco, where for a period of time I was the number two editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. And in 1988, by the way, it was 84 that Murdoch bought the Sun-Times. And in 88, I had become friends with the chief financial officer of the Chronicle Publishing Company. And we used to go to lunch and commiserate about how, you know, we should do something for our own selves. And he came to lunch, said one day, let's go to lunch. And he told me that he had raised several tens of millions of dollars to begin acquiring cable TV systems and newspapers, and would I like to join him in this new partnership. And I said, how much does it pay? And he said, double what you make here. And I go, I'm down for that. So that was it. Actually, I didn't say I'm down for that because the expression didn't exist back then. Well, to make a long story short, we didn't buy any newspapers because we couldn't afford to compete with McClatchy that was paying, you know, 35 times EBITDA for a newspaper. So I became a cable guy and wound up running one of the largest cable systems in the country called Intermedia. And I stayed there until the end of 1995. But in the summer of 1995, I went to a conference on the top of a mountain, literally on the top of a mountain in Colorado, for a briefing, a three-day briefing on technology for cable TV executives. And they spent about 10 minutes talking about cable TV, which is, by the way, an extremely boring subject. But they spent 3 days talking about this thing called the Internet. And when I left that conference, I said, I got to get into that. So one thing led to another. By the beginning of 96, I had found my first position as the CEO of a startup company in Silicon Valley, and I wound up running three more companies until the tech bust in 2001. And since then, I've been doing lots of different things all at the same time and learning a lot and thinking deeply and from time to time taking naps, which are very good. And then in the year 2004, it's Christmas time, I was approached by somebody who had some idea about a business model involving blogs and organizing blogs and figuring out which blogs were important. And of course, I'd heard about blogs, but I couldn't understand why anybody would read one, much less write one. But I thought, well, before I make a decision to do this, I should probably see what, you know, this whole blog thing is all about. So I found out that you could go to Google, something called Blogger, and sign up for a blog. And so I started going through the sign up process, and I thought to myself, well, what could I possibly blog about? And I go, well, I could blog about the impact of technology on the media. And I was sitting around trying to think of what to name it, and I was drinking scotch, and the thought Reflections of a News Assessor came to mind, and I wrote a post, and then I wrote another one, and a few days later, I felt the urge to write another one, and the rest is history.
As they say. Now, how would you say the content? I mean, you as a blogger, how would you say your voice, your choice of topics has changed over those 4+ years?
Well, it's either good news or bad news. It hasn't changed that much. I was looking over a couple of my original posts the other day to see whether I was misrecollecting the sorts of warnings that I was issuing literally at Christmas time in the year 2004. And it's the same language. The good news is most people reading it today haven't read it, so it doesn't seem like I'm repeating myself. But if you plucked most of them out, most of the basic ideas and the subjects, if you plucked them out of that context and published them today, to a large degree, they would still be valid. Now, of course, there are different facts and figures. The interesting thing about this, not to seem to I can't take any credit for being that visionary. I never have ever used that word. Although there are many people around here in Silicon Valley who literally list themselves as visionaries.
Yeah, it's a popular term.
Yeah,
there.
But I've never done that, and I'm not suggesting that I am today. But nonetheless, the year 2005 was the year that the newspaper industry achieved its all-time high in advertising revenues. And throughout that year, I was warning that the good times couldn't keep rolling forever. Now, of course, I never imagined things would come apart as quickly as they did, or as viciously as they did. But I was sounding the warning or evoking those themes, let's say, back then, that are essentially the same things that are the same problems that we're talking about today are the problems I was talking about back then. So I guess it means maybe I haven't grown much or something, but this is the same story. It's been the same story for a little over four years I've been writing about it. The only difference between then and now is that we're running out of options. When I say we, I mean publishers. They simply don't have the revenues and profits today that they had in 2005 and 6 and 7 or even 8. And they have more and better established competition eating their lunch. And of course, now anything you try to do, you're doing in the face of the worst economy in my lifetime and yours. So this is a very, very difficult situation now. And we already know that a certain number of newspapers, among other types of media, won't get out of this alive. And we've seen magazines close. We've seen newspaper close. We don't have any idea what the model is for news weeklies, for goodness sakes. They can't even, they can't even fathom having them out weekly anymore. I mean, what's Newsweek going to change its name to? News kind of week, semi-week, news every now and then
right.
week? I don't know.
I think the niche that you've carved out for yourself is your financial analyses, which I think are nobody is doing the kind of investigative reporting, I call it, in this area. What kind of a response have you had from the industry to the analyses that you're doing?
Well, it runs across the spectrum. For a long time, there's a lot of denial. I think I know that a friend of mine proposed to the California Newspaper Publishers Association about a year ago. They were looking for a keynote speaker, and he said, get Alan Mutter. And he sent me a copy of the email, so I know it's true. And the email said, we don't want him. He's too negative. I wish I had been too negative. Unfortunately, and again, I almost think it's dumb luck, but still in all, I've been more right than I've been wrong about this stuff. I've followed the numbers as far as I could follow them. I'm very careful about making lots of projections. And if you ask me for any today, I probably won't give them, but, I've gone from denial. I've gone to other people who privately say, oh my God, you're right. What are we going to do? And then the other reaction when people aren't in denial is one that's most curious and most troubling. And there are any number of people at extremely senior levels in the newsroom and outside the newsroom, in the advertising department, in the senior management, who say, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what to do about it. I just hope this all lasts long enough so that I can retire. And to me, that is an abrogation of leadership that I find extremely difficult to accept. And I understand why they say it, because again, these people are essentially my peers, and I gather, looking at your picture, your peers. But that ain't good enough, dudes. I mean, we have got to put our heads down and figure out what to do, and we've got to try some new things. And when you suggest to people that they try new things, quite often, I mean, something like 98% of the time, they tell you, well, we can't do that because we've never done it before, or show me a newspaper that's done it successfully, or it's not part of our core business. And I go, what core business? The employment ads, or the auto ads, or the real estate ads, or the Circuit City inserts? What part of the core business is this going to impact? That's the part I don't get.
Well, the core business, of course, is being impacted across the board. I mean, this is a perfect storm situation. Do you look back at any point in the last 10 years when you think this could have been avoided?
Absolutely. First off, as I've said a few times, giving away all this content for free was the original sin. Now, I admit today that it's pretty hard to fix. I mean, the horse is not only out of the barn, but the horse is propagated. The geese are out of the barn. The chickens are out of the barn. Even the cockroaches are out of the barn. It's going to be very hard to put some sort of a for-pay construct over this. But that was the original sin. And the reason it happened is that the newspaper people did not, and I think this is almost universally true, although there probably were some people who were outliers, but newspaper people almost universally had no respect for the internet. They thought it was a joke. They thought it was, you know, who would possibly sit around looking at a computer screen or, nobody, of course, knew what tweeting was then, but it was incomprehensible to anybody to think that any of this would work. So they thought, well, okay, everybody else is putting up a website. You know, Procter & Gamble has a website for Cheer, and, you know, and Coca-Cola has a website. So I guess we need a website. Well, what are we going to put on it? Well, we put out this whole newspaper. Let's throw that up on the web. You know, what the heck? And that was it. There was no thought. So there was simply no thought given to the protection of or the charging for the content. That's number one. And then down the road, there was never really any thought given whatsoever to creating advertising formats that were any different than the ones that they were already using in the newspaper. That's why newspaper websites, around about 60-70% of the revenues tend to come from what they call upsells from classified advertising, meaning that you get the car dealer to pay you something extra to put your ads on the web as well as in the paper. And the dollars and cents of that are commingled because basically the ad rep at the newspaper sells a certain number of dollars worth of advertising, and they push them back and forth about whether or not they're going to be for the web or whether they're going to be for print. And so the idea right now today is not even to have it clear to the customer where the actual dollars are being located. But the point of this is, in the early days, when newspapers had created their websites and put up their content for free, they were actually giving online advertising away as a bonus to people who, you know, bought an extra 30 column or 40 or 100 column inches in the print. They associated no value with the online, and so they tended to not only devalue their content by giving it away for free, but they also tended to devalue their online advertising by giving it away for free. And now, of course, today, advertising has matured to the point that advertisers generally want to pay for cost per acquisition advertising, a kind of little Google keyword ads or a click to get a quote on a new car or click for a free home visit to see how much it'll cost to put in an alarm system. These are the kinds of things that advertisers are looking for, and this is where advertisers want to spend their money. Newspapers have done almost nothing to attract and foster that kind of advertising. So they missed the boat in terms of advertising. The other thing newspapers missed was any number of opportunities to create what I would call web intrinsic types of media. For example, it took some 10 years after my friend Larry Kramer started MarketWatch for the Dow Jones Company to slap itself on the forehead and buy the thing so that they would have an online website about stocks and stock quotes and financial information. And even then, during that whole 10 years, they kept publishing the stock quotes in their newspaper faithfully day in and day out, as though anybody in that era who was remotely interested in business or finance, who had any stocks, were they just waiting for the journal to come in the morning to check their stock quotes? I don't think so. They were on Yahoo Finance. They were someplace.
It's their livelihood.
But they sure weren't waiting for the Wall Street Journal to show up in the morning. Now, that's just one example. Another thing that newspapers completely failed to recognize is that there was a huge opportunity to be the go-to place to figure out where stuff was on the web. This was an opportunity that many people identified, Alta Vista, Yahoo, and this other company called Google. And at any point in time, the newspapers had more than enough money. My God, they make, you know, their profits back then were surpassed by far, by three or four fold profits of an Amazon or Walmart, even, you know, on average, Chevron. So they had more than enough money that they could have had their own solution to search. And had they done that, they would have had the traffic today, and they would have had, presumably at some point, stumbled upon the whole idea of keyword advertising, which Google appropriated from Overture. So, you know, there are any number of things that they could have done. They could have created Yelp. They could have created any number of other sites. Yeah, Google. They could have created Google. Yelp. They could have done
Kaboodle, social shopping sites. So
right, exactly.
Going.com, right. Localized content.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the point is that they stubbornly held to their traditional content and advertising models. And why? You have to say to yourself, why are they that? Are they just like all? Do they all suffer simultaneous brain injuries? No, they did it because they were always afraid that anything they did would cannibalize the existing business. They were afraid that anything that they did might detract from their ability to set local print advertising rates and essentially charge whatever they needed to charge and wanted to charge to assure a steady march in their revenues. And I don't blame them for that. If I had a juicy business, I would do the same thing. But one of the most important things you have to do in business, is to consider your vulnerability. And you have to say, okay, I'm Coke, and everybody, you know, Coke is the word for soda or pop or whatever it is, whatever you call it in your part of the country. That's it. I'm there. I'm Coke. There cannot be anybody else. But then you have to say, so, well, what's the weakness? So when Royal Crown came up with the idea of a diet cola, you know, Coca-Cola kind of scratched its head for a while and said, well, you know, that's not our core business. And then they thought, well, wait a minute. There's too many people buying RC. We better come up with Diet Coke. And when people started drinking juices and bottled water, the Coca-Cola company didn't stick its head in the sand or kick its feet or hold its breath. They bought vitamin water, and they now bottle water. You know, they do everything. And if you take a look at the complete Coca-Cola product line, they go from sugary to natural, from bubbly to still. Any collection of accesses you could come up with for the beverage business apart from alcohol, they do. There's no way that you can not get a Coke product to literally quench your thirst. And the newspaper industry always felt, no, we do Coke, we do classic Coke, we only do it in bottles, we don't do it in cans, you know, we only do it in 16-ounce bottles, whatever it is. I mean, talk about stubbornness. And I realize that it's because the core business was so so profitable and so reliable, but that strength proved to be their undoing.
Are you familiar with Clayton Christensen, Innovator's Dilemma? Is it really? I wonder if they really had a choice. I mean, if you look at the example of, companies like Digital Equipment or Novell or even what Microsoft is going through right now, is it really possible for companies whose platform has been disrupted like that to make the changes, those painful structural changes they need to make to continue to lead the market in the next generation?
I think it's much harder for Microsoft to make a change because there is this inexorable move to open source around the world. Why would I buy I forget how much it costs to buy the Microsoft Office Suite, but let's say it's $400. Why would I spend $400 for that when I can get the Open Office, or I can go to Google and get it for free? So yeah, you're right. That's difficult. But the essential of the newspaper business is not in manufacturing and delivering newspapers. It's in creating valuable and unique content. It's marketing that content and creating a large audience. It's selling that audience for money. It's having the largest number of feet on the street in any given market. It is having a brand that every single person in a market knows, even if they haven't ever in their lives touched the newspaper. They damn well know the name of the newspaper in their community. And there is a certain authority that's associated with the newspaper, even though that's been somewhat eroded over time. And newspaper companies typically have the largest pool, or at least historically have had the largest pool of advertising dollars in their markets. So I call these collectively a phenomenal number of unfair advantages. So if the newspaper deconstructed its strengths into those constituents on unfair advantages I've just described to you, they could create any number of products and services that would take advantage of those unfair advantages, and they could have sustained themselves and taken themselves forward. The problem is they didn't do that. They didn't innovate. They kept trying to preserve, protect, and defend a model that was, as we've seen, destined to fail. And they continue to do that. They do not innovate. Right now, today, newspapers are destroying a key differentiating strength that they have over any other competing media. Any other competing media. And they're destroying that ability to create unique and valuable content, particularly unique and valuable content respecting their local market. Newspapers today are hollowed out, and so the most loyal newspaper readers, who are also discerning readers, have to say to themselves, "Oh my gosh, why am I exactly buying this thing and fishing it out, and, you know, from under the bushes and you know, trying to figure out how to recycle it responsibly and all that stuff? Why bother? You know, there isn't even anything here to read." And I hear that over and over again all across the country. And not just from newspaper people. I try to talk to real people too to keep myself sane. So one of the big problems that we have here is that the newspapers are they're kind of eating their young here. They really are beginning to detract from their core strength. And one of the big arguments, so when we come to the issue, which happens to be the issue of the moment of charging for content, you know, it's getting harder for me to say, oh, newspapers, rightfully you should charge for content, because there's so very little content there that's worth charging for.
You referred earlier to, you said they're destroying a key differentiating strength they have over any other media. What specifically is that?
Well, one of the key strengths is their ability to create unique content. Most radio stations have almost no news staffs. There are a few news radio operations in the country that have a few people, and I respect that. And some of the NPR stations do, although they've gone through enormous cuts. We lost 14% of the staff at KQED here in San Francisco, one of the largest, if not the largest, public radio outlets in the country. And the newspaper has far more, you know, even the smallest, most hollowed out newspaper has more reporters and journalists working than a TV station. And there is nobody after that. So in any given market in the country, as bad off, you know, the LA Times staff has been cut in half. That's a pretty, that's kind of an extreme example. But they've been cut in half, but they still have some 560 or 70 or number of journalists working there figuring out what's going on. Even at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, which appears to be about to get closed, there's a staff of about 140 people. And now, do you suppose there are 140 paid professional journalists working in Seattle apart from the competing Seattle Times? Do you suppose there are 140 journalists in all of the TV and radio in Seattle? I don't think so. I mean, it's a good question I'd have to ask, but I mean, I'm going to throw it out there. So just by one newspaper going down, we're going to lose probably somewhere, but let's at least a third, maybe a half of all the journalistic firepower kicking over rocks in Seattle. There's nobody to replace it. And I don't care how many bloggers and how many goofballs like me you have blogging. It's not the same.
Definitely not the same. But when you picture major cities like that potentially without a newspaper, can you sort of model what the impact of that will be? What do you worry about?
Well, I'll answer the easy part first, and maybe you'll forget the other part. But I worry about the fact that, you know, the press is here to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. You know, to be the fourth branch of government, keeping an eye on the other three. I have a number of these homilies, and you've heard them all. But I actually sincerely believe this. If there aren't trained, reasonably compensated professionals out vigilantly looking for problems to expose, looking for fat cats to bring low, asking questions and sticking up for people who don't have a voice, then we will be a poorer society for it. And in fact, you have to ask yourself, what would the American democracy be like in the absence of a vital and vigorous press? We've never seen that ever. There was a vigorous press in this country before this country was a country, and we've never been in a time when there weren't a lot of people out there poking into public affairs and asking questions and making sometimes trenchant observations about them. We've never seen that before, so I don't know what happened to the democracy. So you say to me, okay, well, if there's a town where there's no newspaper, when the newspaper goes silent forever, what happens? Well, the good news is that I guess human nature, the curiosity of the human beast, abhors a vacuum. And, a young student the other day, you know, I get emails from students asking me, oh my God, I'm majoring in journalism. Should I go kill myself now or what? Or wait for my parents to kill me when they get the bill for college and find out I can't get a job. And I say to them, you know, that there will always be a future for people who are curious and want to get to the bottom of things and tell the story. You know, the first citizen journalist was the caveman who tapped his partner on the shoulder and said, there's a tiger coming after us. We gotta
right.
run. And people will always want to be curious about what's going on around them. People will often, many, many people like to tell people what they know or what they think they know. So the impulse to sort of ask questions and discuss matters, that's pretty deep. I think that's fairly deeply embedded in our RNA. I mean, there are a few subspecies that probably aren't like that in the human race, George Bush being one of them, but the younger. Most of us have an innate curiosity and want to learn things and want to share what we know. So I fully anticipate, and there's no reason to doubt it really, that many people will come forward to attempt to fill what I would call the news vacuum in any given market. If suddenly there were no newspaper in Seattle or San Diego or Chicago or Boston or Tuscaloosa, Alabama, I'm sure somebody somewhere would step forward to try to create something like it. The problem is the resources that will be lost, for example, when the Post PI goes down, those 140 people, there's not 140 people going to just get together on a voluntary basis and cover the cop shop or go to the city hall. It's not going to happen that way. So there will be something that emerges to fill that vacuum of curiosity, but it won't be the same. And it might be better. It might be better, but I think it will. I worry that about that because, number one, we don't know who's going to be asking the questions or doing the writing and who's going to be vetting the information. We don't know whom to believe or whom not to believe. And even let's just say that, you know, Bob Newhart did this routine about the infinite number of monkeys and an infinite number of typewriters being able to write all the great novels. I always think about that when I think about the internet. I'm being one of those monkeys, of course.
Well, I like the quote that says the internet proves that isn't true.
Well, Yeah, except that I haven't seen any great novels written. The impulse to be a monkey at a typewriter, as I said, it runs deep. But there's no barrier to entry, and that's a good thing. It's a beautiful thing. The net is democratized. But this enormous onslaught of information, which just grows almost exponentially, means that anybody who wants to know what's going on, anybody who hopes to be a reasonably informed consumer or voter or citizen or homeowner or parent or whoever you are in this society, you have an enormous burden of trying to figure out, A, where's all the information, since it's no longer conveniently packaged and stuffed in a plastic bag and dropped on your doorstep, as my newspaper was this morning. So finding it is number one problem. Number two problem is absorbing it, organizing it in such a way that you can figure out what's important to read and what's not, what's a time waster, what's real, which guy, you know, what axe does this guy have to grind versus that guy? Because so much of the internet is about opinion. And you earlier on, you said that I'm unusual in that I offer some sort of, often offer some sort of quantitative analysis to accompany my views, and how different that is. Well, you know, if the internet is all about people irping up their views, and they don't ever, we don't know what facts they have or whether they even take note of the facts, you know, this is not actually helping to create a more informed society. It's helping to create a more confused society. And the expression information anxiety comes to mind. I don't have any more anxiety because I have Romanesco to tell me what's going on in my little area that I write about. And then everything after that is just a bonus. If I come across something somewhere of interest that seems right, I read it and I'm happy. But most people don't have Romanesco figuring out what's going on in their world. There's no Romanesco in Rockford, Illinois, or Portland, Oregon, or Framingham, Massachusetts that I'm aware of. So absent that, and absent the newspaper, which was like that back in its day, then I don't know what we're going to have. We're going to have a, you know, Sturm und Drang, but I'm not sure we're going to have much deep insight and a whole lot of actionable, reliable information to guide us as citizens and homeowners and parents and, you know, people who are interested in playing 16-inch softball at the Chicago Park District.
I know you said you didn't want to make predictions, but I have to ask you, given how bad this year is shaping up economically, what do you think is going to happen this year in this industry? Are we going to see mass failures, or are we going to see entire companies just going out of business and these newspapers being thrown on the market for people to buy for pennies on the dollar? What's it going to look like?
Well, some businesses will simply go out of business. We've already seen it. I can safely predict that there will be people who are going to throw the keys on the table at certain newspapers, if you're talking about newspapers, which I gather you are.
Yeah, newspapers.
In other cases, the other issue we really haven't addressed, and I know it's there and I know you're aware of it, is that in addition to failing to recognize the meaning and the profound change associated with the internet, newspaper companies took all those big fat profits that they were booking and they went out and they bought lots and lots of acquisitions. So one of the problems of the newspaper industry today is not necessarily that any given newspaper, like take the Minneapolis Star Tribune, as far as I know, they are making money making the newspaper, you know, writing the paper, just printing it, distributing it, selling ads. But they're not making enough money to stay current with the amount of debt that was placed on the business. Same for McClatchy, same for Lee Enterprises, same to some degree for the New York Times Company, same for Morris. That's what the Default-O-Matic is all about. It's not that the underlying business is so bad. It's just that, or the Tribune Company. How could I forget my favorite one?
How could you?
But it's not that the inherent business of publishing a newspaper is so bad that it is beyond rescue, but it is the fact that almost all these companies are heavily, heavily laden with debt. So probably what has to happen and is happening, we've already seen it begin, is to go through some sort of a markdown of that debt. That's what bankruptcy is all about, to get out to the other side where these companies have reasonable capital structures. And that means that the investors who sponsored these deals, the Sam Zells of the world, or the Avista Partners in Minneapolis, they're going to lose everything they put in. And their lenders who recklessly lent to them in defiance of any sensible fiduciary outlook, they probably will take a large haircut and wind up owning a piece of a newspaper operating company that will be streamlined. That's a nice way of putting it. Even more so than anything we've seen today, to try to eke out a business that's right side up and generate some value for that loan at the end of the day. But suffice to say, the Tribune Company is not worth $13 billion. It's not going to be ever worth $13 billion again in the foreseeable future, unless we have some sort of hyperinflation where people run around with bushel baskets full of $100 bills to buy a loaf of bread. And so we're going to have a major devaluation of these assets. Some of them will be sufficiently healthy as intrinsically healthy as businesses that they can go forward and keep being businesses. Some of them will not be. Evidently, in some markets, they're simply, especially where there's a two newspaper market, the number two paper, it's going to be very difficult for that newspaper to get enough revenue and enough readers to stay in business, and they will close down. But in a market where there is sufficient revenue and sufficient readership to support a newspaper company, then I think newspapers will continue. But the capital structure is going to have to get straightened out, and that's really happening across the entire economy. It's happening with office buildings and shopping malls, and God knows how many hundreds and millions of individual home mortgages. It's happening everywhere because everything was overvalued, and that's what the problem is in the economy. It's General Motors is not worth what everybody thought it was worth, and having a General Motors pension and General Motors healthcare was not worth, could not be supported with the true economics of the business. Everybody's being forced to reconsider. We're all going through reset, including me. I don't have as much money as I used to have, and I didn't have that money to start with, because you actually don't make very much money blogging. But that's what's going on in this country. And so newspapers and all the other media companies are going right along with it. The problem is the newspapers are coming off a very high with very, very high leverage, and a time when suddenly their traditional sources of revenue and profit have dried up almost overnight. And there has to be some real question about whether there isn't a sufficient underlying demand for their product as we know it going forward. In other words, let me say this. General Motors or Chrysler may be in trouble financially. They're certainly in trouble because they're not selling enough vehicles. But I don't for a moment believe that when all this gets sorted out, people won't want to buy cars again. They may or may not be able to buy a Chrysler because Chrysler may be toasto. I mean, you can't buy a Packard as much as you want when you can't buy one. They're gone. Sorry. But people will buy cars. I'm not sure people want to buy newspapers going forward. And certainly all the market studies and demographic data suggests that if you're 30, a newspaper is a non-starter. Buying a newspaper is a non-starter. One of my small journalism class at Berkeley, a dozen students, and well over half of them, and when I asked them, how much time do you spend with a print edition of a newspaper every day, they said none. They're journalism students. Many of them actually have professional experience as broadcasters or elsewhere, but they don't actually read the physical newspaper.
It's stunning. And if you ask, that's journalism students. I do a fair amount of college lecturing myself and ask that question all the time. And it's rare to get more than maybe two hands out of a class of 30 people.
Right.
Who would say that they read a newspaper regularly.
Right. And I'm not sure. I didn't ask that in the class because a certain number of people would just put their hands up because they want me to feel better about myself. They don't realize that it's hopeless. I can't feel any better about myself anymore. I'm done. But it's nice of them to ask. So that's why I need to do it anonymously. And look, the fact is, it's not necessary for people to want to pick up a print newspaper. It's not like we live or die according to that. It's whether we can find the economic model to support professionally generated, professionally edited, professionally produced journalism. And, you know, I mean, we had this whole thing going on about Kachingle, which you probably don't want to go into, at this point.
I saw your comments. Yeah. I saw Outings
yeah,
column. Yeah.
And the idea of Kachingle is that essentially there's this electronic tip jar on a website. I'm sorry, but I don't think most people are accustomed to paying for content anymore. So I don't think that's going to work. So, you know, what is the system to pay for professionally generated content? Another of the silly ideas du jour was, you know, getting $114 billion for somebody to donate $114 billion to endow newspapers. But even the St. Petersburg Times, which is owned by a nonprofit endowment, or the Christian Science Monitor, which is supported by a nonprofit endowment, both of them are in trouble too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Both of them are going through serious retrenchment. And why? Because the underlying economics of the business have changed, and not in a good way. So we need to try to find a way to preserve professional journalism, in my humble opinion. I don't care whether it's on dead trees. That's not what I'm worried about. But I very much worried that I haven't seen the way to do that yet, truthfully. And so, we must labor on. I guess that means I can keep plugging, since I don't have the answers yet. I can keep going.
It seems that the conversation has turned in the last year from saving newspapers to saving journalism, which is probably a healthier discussion to be having. I wonder do you see anybody out there in the traditional media companies, do you see anybody who you think is doing it right?
Well, let's see. In terms of a newspaper company?
Well, yeah, since we both blog about newspapers, let's focus on them. Any of the newspaper companies doing it right?
There are some that do it better than others. I mean, there's some that have certainly evidenced a thoughtful approach, and we always fall back on the same odd little examples, being Lawrence, Kansas, and Bakersfield, California. Lawrence, Kansas... And I know it drives people crazy because we always keep talking about these two places, but there are very few people who've done any innovating, and they've done innovating because they're locally owned. They are not highly leveraged. They don't have debt to deal with. Their local owners live in the town. Their name is on the door, and they want to be proud of the newspaper company or the company that they're running, because they're really more than newspaper companies today. And they're willing to try to invest and reinvest in those businesses, so they'd make much less profit than a Gannett or a McClatchy or a Tribune Company helps to make. So what in Lawrence, Kansas, let's give you a for instance, okay? Lawrence, Kansas is a big university town, and as nice as the local Lawrence newspaper is, the people there fully recognize that there was no way that the students at the university were going to ever to any significant extent buy and look at the Lawrence newspaper. So they decided to create a media presence that would be interesting to university students, and they built it around music and places to go, and it became a pretty popular website. And then they realized that they probably could sell advertising in it for print as well, so they created a print version, and they call it the Deadwood. And it's basically an alternative tabloid paper, similar to, I don't know, was it the Boston Phoenix or the Bay Guardian, San Francisco, or the Chicago Reader? So they created their own alt weekly and website, and they do well with it. That's the kind of thing that you have to do to again going back to that Coke analogy, you know, if not everybody wants Coke, maybe some people want orange juice. Let's buy Minute Maid and make orange juice. We don't care, just as long as they drink it. So in Bakersfield, they've started a dozen different products, from a local garage band site to a hyper-local site where individuals are invited to write for this website, and then they take the best of the content and they put it into print, and they sell it for money. They have another product for second-generation Hispanics who have an affinity for – it's written in English, but they have an affinity for the Hispanic culture. And these are projects that they undertake, and they spend they spend a lot of time and money, invest a lot of time and money in them, and they don't expect anything faster than a 3-year payback. And, you know, some of them may not work. So those, you know, the idea of creating niche publications where you can create specialized content, acquire a large enough, a significant enough audience to attract advertising and selling the advertising, those are all speak to the core strengths of any media company. And one that happens to own printing presses in town and have a bajillion ad salespeople is even luckier. But nobody's doing that. Very, very few people. Another fair example of people who have figured out how to play somewhat outside the box would be the Tribune, Chicago Tribune, where they created free tabloid paper to go to young readers called The Red Eye, which is graphically very appealing. Content-wise, it's light as a feather, but it's about celebrity. It's about, you know, drinking contests. It's about, you know, light stuff. It's not at all about what's going on in Afghanistan or going on in Congress. But they give it away for free, and they sell advertising, and that they purport that it's a for-profit business now. How they allocate the costs, I don't know how really truly profitable it is, but still in all, it's working for them. Then the other thing that Tribune, Chicago Tribune did is they decided to put their street sale version into a tabloid paper. And what they've done now, and they charge for that. So what they've done now is they've bracketed this on Times in Chicago, which is a tabloid newspaper that relies mostly on street sales. They've bracketed both with a free product and a paid product. And at a time when advertising dollars are scarce and the Sun-Times is has very little means to fight back, actually no means to fight back, and they're squeezing it. They're doing it more to sort of put the Sun-Times out of its misery than because of some brilliant strategic initiative. But, you know, in fairness to them, the way they looked at the problem was, we need to put the Sun-Times out of business, and they are proceeding in a very in a pretty effective way.
I know you had your series on the Sun-Times. You seem right to have no hope for the Sun-Times.
Yeah.
I don't want to take any more of your time, because we've already been almost an hour, but this is fascinating to hear what you have to say. I do want to ask about your role as a blogger, and because that's really my day job, and understanding how blogging changes institutions. How has having the blog changed your world?
It's gotten me out of a certain number of household chores, but not all of them. I wouldn't have gotten to meet somebody as interesting and pleasant to visit with as you if it hadn't been for my blog. You would not have otherwise called me randomly. So
well,
I've gotten
you
to connect with a lot of people and learn a lot of things. And but I have to tell you that I know I should be more sophisticated, but every time I find somebody who's pulled up Newsasaur and translated into Swedish or Italian or, you know, languages that I can't even figure out, I get a kick out of that. I mean, you know, to see blah, 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 something in Japanese and then reflections of Newsasaur and then blah, 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 Japanese. It's I find it amusing and cool and fun and gratifying. So I've met a lot of people virtually or otherwise. I've learned a lot. I've I've been able to turn my interests into something that I hope will do some good for other people, and you know, potentially, you know, may amount to perhaps what might be the last act of my career, which is sort of more of a full-time academic position. So, you know, I guess who was it who said baseball had been very, very good to me? You know, blogging
was
been very, very good to me.
Remember the cast? Oh, Garrett Morris. Garrett Morris, yeah.
Right.
Okay. Don't people call you? Don't newspaper companies like want you to come in and consult with them? Or do they just not care? Or are they just too poor?
A few of the smartest ones have, but there's room for more. And the answer is there's been a lot less than I would like and a lot less than I would think. I mean, I think there is some intrinsic value to blogging, but I'm a guy who is accustomed to getting up in the morning and making it happen, whether as a reporter or as an editor or as a business executive. I don't take pleasure in chronicling other people's problems. I do it because I think some of it's important, but I'm a man of action. I mean, I would love to be doing things, getting out there and helping do things and helping people think and rethink their businesses. And even at this late date for many publishing companies, there are things that could be done. And when I sit and talk with some of these senior people in publishing companies and I get arguments about why they can't do it or it's not core to our business or what other newspapers have done successfully, I get nothing but defense ball. And it's like, guys, this is really serious,
uh-huh,
you know?
Uh-huh.
And without going on at further length, although it tends to be one of my problems, you know, going from a newspaper company, which is bolted together a kind of a business, a traditional business as you could imagine, eventually into Silicon Valley, which is by definition unbolted, you realize that people who work in newspaper companies are not accustomed to dealing with uncertainty. They're not accustomed to innovating. They're not accustomed to looking at their existing models and being willing to blow them up. Let me give you one fast example. In the early days of the Internet, there was this company called Netscape that sold a web browser that allowed you to figure out what was actually there, right? It would turn all this code into something presentable. And then along came this other company and said, you know, we don't want them to be that successful. We're going to do the same thing, but give it away for free. And that company, of course, was Microsoft. And they did a marvelous job of blowing up Netscape to the point that nobody knows what Netscape is anymore. So as big and powerful and as iconic as Netscape was, and I cannot tell you what a big deal it was. I mean, I literally worked down the block from Netscape on the day they went public. Somebody ran and poured green dye into the fountain in front of the building, and it was spewing green water. To see that go from ginormous to literally a footnote in a blink of an eye, you understand that the pace of business, especially in the media business, especially in the technology side of the media business, the pace is just blinding. And you have to be able to walk in the morning, even if you were successful in the last quarter, and ask yourself, what's our vulnerability in the upcoming quarter or two quarters down the road? What can I do? You know, am I on the right track? Is this a trajectory that will be successful, or will this blow up in my face? And if the latter is the case, what can I do about it here and now today? And what do I have to do to sort of creatively destroy my business to live another day? None of that thinking exists in the newspaper business. And that's why I guess I don't get very many calls, because people don't want to be confronted with their problems, and they don't want to be confronted with the awfulness in their minds of having to change. I'd like to tell them that, you know, go with the Tai Chi of it. I'm from California. I can say stuff like that. You know, go with the flow. Change is good. You just need, but don't just let change happen to you. Let grab that change in both hands and direct it in a way that works for you and works for your business and works for the people who depend on you. And the people who depend on newspapers include not only the people in the building and their family, and the colleges that reporters and editors are paying tuitions to for their kids. It really is the whole community and the whole society. So there's lots of people who, there's lots of people depending on these guys to get it right. And I'm surprised, frankly, that I guess of anything, the thing that surprises me the most is how few people really are trying to get it right. They just don't get, they just don't know what they don't know. They just don't get it.
And there you have it, an hour with Alan Mutter, the reflections of a newsosaur blogger, in many ways the financial conscience of the industry. Thank you for staying with us today, and be sure to check newspaperdeathwatch.com for continuing updates on the state of the industry, the decline of newspapers, and the rebirth, we hope, of journalism. This is Paul Gillen.